Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about what else? The Iditarod, a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. I'm your host, Josh Edge. Mitch Seavey is in the lead, followed by his son Dallas and Wade Mars, as race leaders make a break for the coast. But before we get into today's episode, here's a quick word from our sponsor.
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, celebrating 40 years of fueling the 49th state, is proud to support Iditarod coverage on Alaska Public Media.
Both Seavey's, Wade Mars, Nicholas Petit, and Yor Olsa make up the Iditarod's top five. They've gained a little separation from the rest of the pack as they make their way to Unalakleet, then up the coast to Shaktulik. Just a reminder, we are in the middle of producing our daily episodes, which we'll keep pushing out until the end of the race. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher, or listen on alaskapublic.org. Both of our trail reporters, KNOM Radio's Ben Matheson and Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes, checked in overnight with some updates from the trail. Before we get into what they had to say, though, there are a couple other updates that came in after they went to bed last night. Ryan Anderson, a rookie from Minnesota, scratched at Galena overnight. Also, Iditarod officials say a gross necropsy has been completed on Smoke, the dog from musher Scott Smith's team that died while in transit from Galena to Anchorage. Iditarod officials say the findings of the necropsy were consistent with hypothermia, though more testing still needs to be done. All right. Now, Mitch Seavey was the first musher to reach Caltag. He arrived at the Yukon River checkpoint at 7:40 yesterday evening. He blew through Nulato in the heat of the afternoon and declared his eight-hour rest upon checking into Caltag, the last possible spot to take that rest. And as the race leaves the Yukon River on an 85-mile portage trail to the coast, Ben was able to catch up with Mitch, who says he's pretty confident at this point.
This isn't even really that hard. I mean, I hate to say that like that, but the way we train, I mean, I ended up telling Dallas it's only 1,000 miles. We just do what we've been doing, go 9, 10 miles an hour and take short breaks. And I mean, it's going to be hard because we're going to put the hammer down, but to here, we're sort of maintaining. And we put a little bit of a push on today because you got to make use of this 8, right? So I did a couple shorter stops, but speed was the same. The dogs are happy. They ate every scrap.
For being the first to reach Caltag, Seavey won the Bristol Bay Native Corporation Fish First Award, and that includes $2,000 cash and 25 pounds of Bristol Bay salmon. The race picture is finally coming into focus now that the top teams have completed their mandatory rests. Seavey is going to swap out his large sled for a smaller, more nimble one as he heads to the coast, and he has strategically rotated out his dogs from the gang line throughout the race to rest in the sled, but he says that technique is coming to an end.
Whatever we do will just be to keep the speed in the dogs. I don't want to slow down very much. It takes too long and it's too boring. I don't want to slow down. Maybe right at the end, you know. So keep resting them, keep taking good care of them. We're going to have to, be clever because those guys coming behind me haven't given up.
Now, Seavey has a shot at earning his third Iditarod title. He says he's too tired to be nervous, but he knows there are several young mushers pushing into Caltag overnight that are looking to make a move.
I guess I'm a little bit anxious because I'm in a position where I could win this thing, you know, if something doesn't go wrong, but my son Dallas is extremely tough and extremely competitive. He's already talking to me like, oh, you've got this sewn up. I think he's playing poker. I don't think he believes that. He won't quit. He won't give up, so it'll be a race. I think I have more speed and a better position, but that can change.
Mitch has placed second to Dallas in the past two races. Now, as the race approaches the coast, there's some poor trail conditions on a lengthy stretch of the Iditarod route earlier that may be giving a boost to some of the mushers at the front of the pack. Mushers that arrived in Koyukuk yesterday afternoon and into the evening reported a slow, grueling trail down that 86-mile stretch from Huslia back down to the Yukon River.
It's just like eggshells. Like, if you break through, it's very, very punchy.
Jesse Royer made that trip with a straight run that lasted over 12 hours, and that was just in part because she wanted to get ahead of the other mushers before they tore up the trail anymore.
Anytime I passed a team, it got better. So So I'm glad I'm further up because I don't think it's... I think it's just going to keep getting worse for all those teams behind.
Royer was the sixth musher into that checkpoint. And then throughout the evening, mushers lamented to one another the slog getting into the checkpoint. Explanations ranged from the trail not having a solid base layer to inconsiderate snow machiners. But race veteran Ali Zirkel pointed out that the mushers may have gotten a little spoiled after all the pristine conditions for so many of the earlier legs of the trail. Now, as we heard earlier, Wade Mars is in the top five. He's running in third place as of the recording of today's episode. Our trail reporters checked in with him twice yesterday. First, Zach was able to talk with him in Koyukuk as he prepared to run for the coast against Mitch and Dallas Seavey. Let's hear it.
We're going to find out very soon with how this team comes off this camp if they're capable of making the same moves as them or not. Right now, I think it's most likely just because Dallas is hauling dogs, but at the moment we're moving faster than him. But maybe when he gets his lighter sled and runs all the dogs at once, he'll probably be going faster than us, you know, at that point. So if he does that and speeds up again, I don't know that I'll be able to keep up with him, but never know. They might leave here like the rocket. So it's freaking dogs. Can't just tell them to run 10 miles an hour. You gotta let them do what they want to do.
And are you keeping an eye on Mitch the same way?
Oh, most definitely. Mitch is already going faster than us, and he hasn't even switched sleds yet. So, but we've watched Mitch do this a lot, and his team, I don't know if his team fades across the coast every year or if he does a little bit. Not every year, but the last couple years against Dallas, it seems like he'll be going faster and looking a heck of a lot better than Dallas at this point. And then by the time they get to White Mountain, Dallas has him beat. So, I don't know. If we see that in Mitch, then we might get lucky. But we'll see what happens.
So that was in Koyukuk. Then a ways down the trail, Ben caught up with Wade Mars again in Caltag. And that was actually at about 4 a.m. this morning. That's 4 a.m. Sunday morning.
It's all up to the dogs now. I just got to put my back into it and keep them moving and hope that they have a good run.
You know, there are some teams here that have really worked to preserve their speed. And, you know, Nick's got a really fast run, faster than Mitch coming over to this part. How do you feel about your team's overall speed right now?
They don't have a lot of speed, but they're still moving pretty good, and we have enough of a lead on Nick and them. Hopefully we can hang on to it, but never know, he could run an hour faster than me on this run, and then he'll probably have me. But we've seen Nick do, you know, a lot of this, and then he does a big 8-hour rest on the coast. And so hopefully, yeah, I don't know, I wish you guys good luck. So his team looked really awesome. So
again, that second interview between Wade Mars and Ben happened around 4 o'clock this morning. It's just incredible the difference in voices and tone after that many hours on the trail. So we heard from Wade in Koyukuk and Caltag. In between those checkpoints lies Nalado. It was outside that checkpoint last year that a snow machiner attacked Jeff King and Ali Zirkel's teams as they approached. So yesterday, about 1 year later, Ben was able to talk with Nalado's head checker, Larry Smalcom.
And I guess the plan wasn't to have the Iditarod in Nalado until it was moved with the course. And I guess I'm wondering what your thoughts are following, you know, that incident on the trail that kind of took up a lot of hard feelings last year. What's it like to have the racers back just 1 year later?
They're more than welcome. Like I told other reporters, I don't dwell on the past. Here's a totally different year. And every musher is going to get equal treatment. Mm-hmm. Nobody, there's no favorites in Nalado. Everybody, equal opportunity to do what they want. They all get treated the same.
5 years in a row, though, does that, that probably hasn't happened before ever.
No, but we're enjoying it. We welcome there. You can see all the food coming in, just sitting here. Well, what made my days, I didn't have to ask for help. All the help came. Even the visitors, like we got 40 or 50 people in my gym right now, and they're all eating good.
All right, well, thank you very much, Larry.
Thank you.
Switching gears a bit, since we started making this podcast, we've been delighted with how many listeners have reached out with their own questions. We kind of figured it would be mostly folks in Alaska or maybe our siblings in Minnesota, but we actually got one recently from abroad about how mushers from other countries get their dogs to the Iditarod.
Hi, my name is Lynn, and I listen to the Iditapod from Oslo, Norway. I'd like to know about the logistics involved for the international racers, especially what it takes to transport the dogs from their home country to Alaska. Do the dogs get air freighted into Alaska, or do they travel in the cargo holds of passenger planes? And can they make the long trip from Europe in a single go? My last trip to Alaska took about 22 hours, which seems like a long time for a dog to be cooped up. I'd also like to know how far in advance of the race the mushers and their dogs arrive in Alaska. Thanks so much for your great coverage of the Iditarod. I look forward to hearing the next episode.
To find out the answer, Zach spoke with Mats Pettersen, a race veteran from Sweden.
Yeah, doing like this is not a big crew. It's only me and have a friend helping a little bit. So it's quite much work before the race. Everything get done. Travel here with dogs. I can take four dogs per flight when I travel. So I've been running actually back and forward myself and have the dogs at my good friend Lindo Fiedler's place in Willow. So he helped me a lot with that. So I think he was a really big support from us this year. So we can have the dogs there. So. But yeah, it takes lots of time, also do all food drops yourself and whatever. So before the race starts, you're thinking, I'm not doing this again. But when you are out here, and then you feel better every time, so that's what we like.
Do you how much would you estimate is the additional expense for somebody coming from Scandinavia or even any foreign country to bring all the dogs over into Alaska to run compared to somebody on the road system?
I would say around, I do a small budget thing, really small budget thing. I'd say like that the cheapest you can do it around 20, 25,000. That's what it costs for me to come over and do the race.
If you have your own question about the race, please send it our way. You can email them to iditarod@alaskapublic.org. Better yet, record yourself on a smartphone and email us. You can use a voice recorder or memo app. Almost all phones have these. Introduce yourself, tell us where you're from, and ask away. And we'll get to as many of these as we can before the race is done. So, sticking with the international racers, by my count, in this year's race, 11 mushers from outside the U.S. left the starting line in Fairbanks, so I figured it might be a good time to check in on them. First, let's hear from Ralph Johansson from Norway. He's arrived in Kaltag, but Ben was able to check in with him back in Huslia. Let's hear what he had to say.
I wonder, in Norway, you know, the early winter is probably pretty dark and, depending on where you're training, darker than parts of Alaska. Do you get daytime training before springtime, or does it tend to be more dark nighttime training?
In all the place in the south of Norway, up in the mountain, we have daylight from in December and November, December. We have daylight from 10 o'clock to 3 o'clock. So 3-4 o'clock, so I couldn't train in daylight all year. Mm-hmm.
Now the coast is where races really come to be. How do you set your team up to make it to the coast in a position that allows you to succeed at the end?
Well, I have rest a lot early in the race, And now after 24, I think they look good, so I will still rest a bit. But you can't rest so much after this, so if the team don't aura, you have nothing to compete in. But I'm not thinking so much on place and which place I should finish. I think about to have a good run with my dog. So, and if it's good, mostly will be a good place too, I think.
Ben also caught up with French musher Nicolas Vanier while he was in Huslia.
So you've completed the Yukon Quest before and done some really big adventures. How does the first half of Iditarod, you know, match up with your expectations of Iditarod?
Oh, it's great, you know. It's I'm not used to get so nice trail, you know, very well marked. You have food in the checkpoint, which are very near one from to one, you know. So good trail, good food, very well marked, so you're never lost. So I'm not used to that. So I understand why there is so many musher on the Iditarod, because it's great, but it's very impressive also how fast those front musher are going. It's just crazy, you know. I don't even understand how they do that.
We do have one more thing for you today. While mushers along the Iditarod Trail are enjoying good trail conditions, the same is not true for Idita Sport. The event bills itself as a human-powered ultramarathon where participants bicycle and walk their traditional Iditarod route. It ended prematurely when all of the competitors scratched. The first Idita Sport was in 1997, but it went defunct in the 2000s. This year, to commemorate the 20th anniversary, it was relaunched, though poor snow conditions along one section of the trail rerouted the Iditarod sled dog race. The three Idita Sport participants set out from Big Lake and toward the Alaska Range on the heels of the Iron Dog in mid-February. But as Zach found out, getting just halfway to Nome was nearly impossible.
Jan Kryska looks severely beaten up.
I've been frostbitten 4 or 5 days ago, and so those my fingers, and they were a minor frostbites, but they became major frostbites.
Kryska is a doctor, originally from Slovakia, but now living on a farm in North Carolina. His nose is discolored. Fat bandages swaddle fingers that look a disturbing shade of purple, and he can barely walk.
Friction and the pressure and then no circulation plus cold caused basically a big set of chunks of foot, you know, side of the foot to be missing.
We're talking in Ruby, which Kryska was only just barely able to reach as he ran, walked, and post-holed through hundreds of miles of remote country. He's one of just a handful of people who entered the Idita Sport hoping to reach Nome following the traditional Iditarod route. But this year, because the sled dog race was rerouted to Fairbanks, there was even less traffic along the trail heading up and over the Alaska Range toward the Yukon. And recent snows, along with deep cold, made everything even more challenging.
The accumulation of the snow later on, the section between McGrath and then Ruby was essentially... There was no trail because Iron Dog had gone through a long time ago, and then accumulation of the new snow pretty much abolished the trail, existing trails.
Though the Idita Sport requires entrants to have completed an Alaska winter event, it only has to total 370 miles. Survival training is mandatory, but the program is just 8 hours long. Kryska has done other cold weather events, but he wasn't prepared when things started going wrong.
I thought I'm not going to make it, you know. I mean, it was I lost my snowshoes, I didn't have matches, so I could not make a water. It was minus 40. Then I lost, you know, the stove stopped working. So I decided I'm not going to bivvy out anymore, so I pushed the last 30 miles through the night and came here at 3 o'clock in the morning.
He was in touch with race organizers through a two-way communicator, so they had an idea of where he was and what was going on. But even Kryska says he didn't know how bad things were until he visited the clinic in Ruby and saw the extent of the damage to his feet. Idita Sport doesn't have staff beyond McGrath, where a number of participants ended a similar, shorter outdoor race. Now, Kryska's preparing to catch a plane back to Anchorage. He isn't alone. Another runner trying to reach Nome is Jorge Latre, who reached Ruby a few hours after Kryska flew out.
You're going at less than a mile an hour, and you're in a 1,000-mile race, so you think you're going to spend the rest of your life doing that. The three last nights were very cold, all of them below minus 30. And so it took a lot of skill not to lose your fingers or toes or nose, as you had to go about your normal routine, like just putting on and off your gaiters. that time is enough to actually freeze your fingers off. And so every single activity becomes harrowing and difficult.
Latreille is in much better shape than his trailmate. Though he's got a bandage over his nose, he looks otherwise unscathed as he shovels down a plate of fresh fruit, pancakes, and breakfast meats. But he's not going any further. He thinks it was just a rough year in terms of conditions and doesn't see the need to push his luck. Latreille believes the safety precautions for the race are adequate, so long as you know how to identify trouble.
People know where you are, and you can send for an SOS, you can call for help, you can call with questions, you can, so you have a line, and people know where you are. So if things get totally out of hand, you can be rescued or at least pull through self-rescue. But absent that, you're on your own.
Neither Latreille or Kryska knew if they'd try the race again. Reporting from the Iditarod Trail, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
That just sounds absolutely brutal. That is all we have for you today. Thanks again to Zachariah Hughes with Alaska Public Media and to KNOM Radio's Ben Matheson. Again, we are in the midst of our daily episodes, so if you like what you hear, you can tune in every day during the race. To make that a little bit easier, you can subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher or listen on alaskapublic.org. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras, and I'm Josh Edge. Goodbye.
I think I'm going to go with all 13 of them. It might be a mistake. I might end up hauling one, but it won't be too big of a deal if I do, so I got enough power. If I haul one, it won't be too devastating.